Hello and welcome back to the More Than Money podcast. As always, I'm your host, Ross Murray. And on this episode, we are answering your money question. So as always, if you have a question that you'd like answered on a future episode, be sure to follow the link in the description below and I'll do my best to answer your questions. All right, so let's jump in today's episode.
Welcome to More Than Money with your host, Ross Murray. This episode of More Than Money is brought to you by More Time Financial, a financial planning company who are on a mission to help young Australians make smarter decisions with money by providing real-life financial advice, coaching, and financial education.
The first question came in from Tom. Tom asks, how can I start investing in the Australian stock market with a small amount of money? So Tom, what I'd be thinking there is jump back to episode, I believe it was 45 or 46, where we covered investing for beginners in a lot more detail. So jump over there and have a listen to that. The things I'd be thinking about here is you can start investing in what's called a micro investing platform. So there's a number of micro investing platforms out there. Jump online, have a quick Google search and just search for micro investing platforms Australia. And the beauty of that is these investment platforms let you start investing with a really small amount of money. So some of them as low as I believe like $10 or maybe $50. So what you can get set up for free, start investing there. And then the other thing to think about is rather than just making one investment into one share or one company, when you're beginning, it can be worthwhile to think about investing in potentially like an ETF or a diversified managed fund where it gives you a broad spectrum of investments. And the reason we like to do that for clients is rather than just seeing the performance of one share, it lets you see the performance of all different shares in all different markets. And it gives you a bit of a broader understanding of how different shares work and what that might mean in terms of when you actually start getting more money, where can you allocate your money after that. So that would be my thinking for that one. Thanks, Tom. All right, so next question came in from Sarah. Sarah asks, how much of my income should I be saving each week, or what percentage of my income should I be saving each week? So Sarah, this is a bit of a tricky one to answer. Now, there's a mathematical approach to say, okay, you should be saving 20%, and that seems to be the general standard in the financial community. And it is a really good amount, 20%. If you were able to save 20% of your salary, that would be fantastic. However, it's really going to depend on a number of things. It's going to depend on your situation, your goals, your plans, what's happening in your world. Think about when you're getting started is trying to save as much as practically possible. Now, we can have the goal of saving 20%. That would be fantastic, but it may not be practical right now. You may be taking time off work. You may be in between jobs. You might be renting in a super expensive city. Like, just a number of things might not allow you to be able to save that. However, it's important that you are saving an amount. So we always suggest that we want to make sure that number one, your income is more than your expenses, so that you are saving something. That's step number one. Now, once we've got that under control, then we can start reaching a bit higher. Say, okay, at the moment, you're spending way more than you're earning, so you're not saving anything, you're going backwards. That would be step number one, get you to that point where you are breaking even. And then how do we actually start saving? And then how can we increase that to say, what does it look like if we save 5% of our income? What does it look like if we save 20, 30 potentially? So start small and work up and have that goal. If you have nothing, you're not sure, have that goal of 20% can be a really good goal to have, but it's really going to depend on your situation and your circumstances. But that would be my thinking there. Thanks for the question. So the next question came in from Jack. Jack asked, what factors impact my credit score or credit history in Australia? So thanks for the question, Jack. Credit scores and credit history can be a little bit of a tricky one. Understand here is it's all dependent on previous behavior. So what have you done in the past, which is going to impact your credit score, credit history today. So that's what we call it, obviously, credit history. Now, the things here are anytime you've had a bill or you've had money owing to someone, so this could be a utility bill, phone bill, whatever it is, then and you're late or you've defaulted, that goes against your history. So they put a mark to say, Jack didn't pay or was late on his phone bill, defaulted on his phone bill, was 6 months late on this, whatever that is, that all starts to add up. So anytime you've either borrowed money, you've entered into a contract with someone, like a utility provider, you've taken out a loan, taken out a credit card, maybe you've applied for a personal loan, you've used Afterpay, ZipPay, anything where you are borrowing money or potentially interacting with another service provider can have an impact on your credit history. So if you have a good credit history, it means that you have potentially borrowed money in the past or you've used different services in the past, and every single time you've used them, you've paid on time, you've never defaulted, you haven't got any late fees, you've had a really good history. So that would start to add up. Say, look, Jack, for the past 10 years, you've maybe used a credit card, you've taken out a personal loan, maybe you've used Gem Visa, you've used Afterpay, you've interacted with different phone providers, utility providers, internet providers, and every single time you've met the repayments on time, you've never been late, we haven't had any issues, we haven't had to send any late notices, that would be a good credit history. Now, if we think about the inverse of that is you've used all these providers, you've had multiple credit cards, multiple loans, and every single time you've been late on your payments, you've missed the due date, you only pay the minimum, you've maybe got a black mark, maybe you had to default on a loan, maybe you didn't pay utility bills on time and they've been chasing you up for 6 months, all those things can have a negative impact. So then when you go to borrow money in the future for maybe a house deposit, which is the big one for most people, and the bank runs a credit history check and they go, oh, great, we can see that Jack, applicant number one, he's had a really good credit history, he's used credit in the past, he's used loans in the past, but every single time he's been really good and diligent about it, that's a candidate for a future home loan application. Whereas you take the other person, then they've had done the similar thing, they've borrowed all this money, or maybe they've used different utilities and providers, but they've always been late, and then they've got a bad credit history. So those are things to think about when you're thinking about credit histories and credit reports. Now, it's really important that you understand what your credit history and credit report is. And there's a lot of free services out there that let you do a quick search and they'll send you a report to give you a breakdown of where you're sitting. It's always important to make sure that's up to date and there wasn't any loans or anything that maybe were in your partner's name or someone you've lived with that's impacting your credit history or could potentially impact your borrowing capacity in the future. All right, so next question comes in from Emily. Emily asks, what are the tax benefits of making superannuation contributions? So this is a little bit confusing because anything to do with superannuation can sometimes be confusing, but mainly the benefits when it comes to allocating money into superannuation is, as we've spoken about in a previous episode where we talked all about superannuation, the government is trying to incentivize people to save for their own retirement. The way they do that is they have a lower tax rate inside superannuation than they do for majority of people. Their marginal tax rate is going to be higher than it is inside superannuation. So that's one, that any money inside superannuation gets taxed at a lower threshold than it does potentially outside of superannuation. And then the other big one is that they incentivize people by giving them a tax deduction of putting extra money into superannuation. So if you make a tax deductible contribution into superannuation, you can then claim it as a tax deduction. So a couple of ways to do that is you can make a personal contribution or you can set up a salary sacrifice agreement with your employer and they deduct money on your behalf and send it straight to the superannuation company. Now, it's really important that you understand, before you start doing that, you understand what you're doing, what you're getting into, what the rules and implications are if you break those rules. So number one there is there are limits to how much you can put into superannuation. And then the other one is it's really important that if you are going to do this for tax purposes, you talk to your accountant to make sure it's suitable for you. And then also talk to your superannuation fund to find out, okay, if I am going to make this contribution, what do I need to do to notify you that I want to claim it as a tax deduction? So there's a couple of things to think about there. However, it can always be a really good idea to be contributing some money into superannuation. And as I said, you get the tax benefits and then you get the double benefit of saving for your future retirement as well. All right, so the next question came in from Liam. Liam asks, how can I potentially negotiate a higher salary for myself with my current employer? So this one, Liam, is really going to depend on your type of employment and the industry that you're in. Now, the things to think about here is firstly understanding, okay, what am I actually getting paid? Now, we spoke about this in, I believe, the last episode where we demystified some of the things where it's not always just the headline salary that it's important to look at. Understanding, okay, I'm getting paid a salary. Does that include, does it exclude superannuation? Am I getting any other perks and benefits? Now, the reason to think about that before you start negotiating higher salary is just understanding, okay, what am I currently getting paid? What is reasonable for my experience, my industry, my occupation? And understanding that will allow you to say, okay, well, everyone wants to be getting paid more, but is it actually reasonable that you may be getting paid a lot more than the average person? So therefore, you might have a harder time to negotiating that salary with your employer. So that'd be my first thing, is do your research, understand, okay, exactly what am I getting paid right now and what is the industry standard for someone, my position, my experience, my industry. That would be that number one. Number two is then understanding, okay, what am I bringing to this company? So if you can have a really clear case, so rather than just going to your employer and saying, hey, you need to pay me more, otherwise I'm quitting, that doesn't really leave your employer in a very nice position, because it's either, well, maybe they can't afford to pay you more, maybe that you're getting paid more than you should be. But then the other one is, well, if they don't pay you more, then you're quitting. So that puts them in a hard position of either they're going to pay you more to keep you, but then that's going to be reluctant and then might cause some future issues. So thinking about, okay, well, if I am wanting to get a higher paying salary for this role that I'm doing, what else can you provide to your employer? So if you can go to them and say, hey, I would really like to be getting paid more. I understand. I don't know if that's possible right now or not, but what could I be doing to go from earning $100,000 a year to earning $120,000? How can I add more value to you or to the company in order to get that salary, that higher salary in weeks, months, time, whatever that might be? And that shows your employer that you're working with them to say, okay, you want to provide more value, assuming you're not providing enough at the moment, provide more value to them to then make you more valuable and therefore get more value from them in terms of an extra salary. The other one is just thinking about other benefits. So it may not be monetary value that you're trying to increase. You might not be trying to negotiate a higher salary per se. It may be other incentives and things that, okay, well, can you potentially work from home and get paid the same? What does it look like if you do a 4-day work week instead of a 5-day work week, but pay the same? As long as you're doing the work, does it really matter? Can you get car allowances? Can you get extra time off? Whatever that might be to kind of incentivize you more to want to stay at the company, then all those things could be on the table as well. So rather than just going to your employer and saying, hey, pay me more, otherwise I'm quitting, you can go to them with a range of different options to say, hey, this is what I'm thinking. Here's how I think it could work. What are your thoughts on this? Like, can we work together to figure out this plan? And I think going in with that attitude is a lot better in the employer eyes, and me being an employer as well, I think that's a lot better attitude to have and could potentially be helpful. So hope you find that helpful and let me know how you go with the pay rise. All right, so next question came in from Mia. Mia asked, what are some strategies and tips to pay down my HEX and get rid of other debts that I have as well? So Mia, this is a topic that I'm super passionate about, trying to get a lot of people out of debt as quick as possible and finding a lot. Far too often people have too much credit card debt, too much personal loan, and then HEX debt is another one to think about as well. So I really appreciate the question. First things first, I would suggest you jump back to episode 48, where we cover a lot more detail about all things debt, how to pay off your debt, and what you could be doing to get on top of your debt. So I suggest you do that one. Have a good look at that episode. The second thing I'd be thinking about is we want to get super, super clear on what debts you currently have right now. So exactly how much do you owe? What is the interest rate you're incurring on each of those loans? And what is the minimum repayment? Also, what is a potential any annual fees or additional fees you might be paying for those debts? So get 100% clear on all of those, including all the credit cards, personal loans, Afterpay, ZipPay, HEX debt, home loans, whatever you have, list them all down. Then you want to think about which debt strategy you want to go with. Now, again, in episode 48, I cover this in a lot more detail, but ultimately you've got these two different debt strategies. You've got the debt snowball, which I'll explain in a second, and then you've got the debt avalanche. Regardless of which strategy you choose, the important thing to consider is you are making the minimum repayments on all of your debts at all times. So that's by understanding exactly what debts you have and what the minimum repayments are, is going to allow you to do that. So that's step number one. It's really important that you make the minimum repayments, or you are making and you continue to make the minimum repayments on all of your debts. Once you've done that, then choosing the debt snowball or the debt avalanche. Now, the debt snowball is we've found, and the research shows, that it's a better one psychological wise because it lets you have little wins as you progress. So this is assuming you've got multiple debts. The idea here is that you continue to make the minimum payments on all debts. You list out your debts smallest to largest in the balance owing. So the amount owing, smallest to largest, continue to make all the minimum payments on all loans, and then take any extra money that you do have. So this could be additional savings, bonuses, tax refunds, any extra money you can pick up from work, any extra income, and pump that into the lowest debt you have. Once that lowest debt is cleared, then you move on to your next debt. So you take the minimum repayment you're making, your lowest one, plus the additional repayments, and then put it into your next lowest one. Once that's gone, you repeat, you repeat, you repeat. And the reason it's called the debt snowball is that as you progress, you pick up pace. And then by the time you get to your last debt, you're making really high repayments on that, and that's going to clear it as quick as possible. Now, conversely, the debt avalanche, the goal is still the same, is to get out of debt as quick as possible. But instead of looking at the lowest balance owing, it takes the highest interest rate that you have on your debts. So this would be listing all your debts in the form of highest interest rate first, all the way down to the lowest. And the idea is same, make minimum payments on all your loans, and then take any extra money you've got, any extra savings, and plow it into the highest interest rate loan that you have, and work down to the lowest one. So hopefully that's helpful. Let me know how much debt you have or how quickly you can think you might be able to get out of debt. There are a number of debt calculators. Again, jump back to episode 48 and have a look and listen to that one. Let me know how you go. Next question came in for Ethan. Ethan asked, how can I build up 6 months worth of living expenses in the form of savings? All right, so Ethan, hopefully you've been listening to a couple of the previous podcast episodes where we talk about this all the time, which the goal is to build up a minimum 3 months. So you're talking about 6 months, which is fantastic. How do we actually go about doing that? So first of all, we need to figure out what that figure is. So understanding what your living expenses are on a monthly basis, weekly basis, however you want to figure it out, work that out on a 6 monthly basis so that we have that clear figure in mind. Now, the thing I'd be doing here is rather than just having that big goal, say, okay, maybe that's $30,000, for instance, that could be intimidating if you're starting absolutely zero. So the thing I'd be thinking there is, okay, how do we break it down to, okay, well, maybe it's a $5,000 increment that we're aiming for. So once we know what that goal is, then it's important to understand, okay, you've just looked at your living expenses. What can we do to increase our savings? Do we have an income problem or do we have an expenses problem? And the reason we think about that is, how much are you earning versus how much are you spending? Is it possible to increase your income? Is it possible to decrease your expenses? Maybe you can do both. So previous episodes, we've talked about what those options are, and very, very simplistically, not that makes it easier, but very simplistically, we can increase our income, we can decrease our expenses, or we can potentially do both. Now, the reason we want to do that is, any extra money that we've got left over in the form of savings, then we can put towards our savings. Now, once we know how much we're aiming for, how much we can save on a weekly basis or fortnightly basis, then it's a matter of going into our money calculators online and figuring out how long is that going to take you. If it's not fast enough, if you want to do it quicker, then it's a matter of figuring out, okay, can I earn more? Can I spend less? Can I potentially do a bit of both? Now, the next question to think about there is, once we've got those answered, is where we're going to store that money. So my suggestion there would be creating a separate bank account, separate savings account, and finding a reasonably paying or high interest savings account to put all of your money in there. Keep it separate from your bills account, keep it separate from your spending account, and do your best, unless it's some form of emergency that actually pops up, not something that you just want to buy some new clothes or go on holiday. If it's actual an emergency, then by all means use that money because that's its intended purpose, but try your best to not touch that money until you reach that goal. So thanks for the question, Ethan. All right, so next question came in from Olivia. Olivia asks, what are the pros and cons of renting versus buying a property in Australia? All right, so thinking firstly, purchasing a property gives you a number of options which can be really beneficial. One, if you own your own house, you're allowed to then do whatever you want to it, subject to body corporate laws if you're in a house, in a unit or a townhouse. But assuming you have a house, you can then do whatever you want to it. You have the flexibility to rent it out, Airbnb it, renovate it, paint it, do whatever you want. So that's one benefit. The other one is the capital appreciation. So by owning an asset, we know that property in most places tends to increase in value over the long term. So that is what's called capital appreciation or equity. So the longer you hold a property, if it's a good property in a good area, etc., then more times than not, you're going to increase your equity or your asset value. So that can be really beneficial. The downside of purchasing and living in a property, one is the purchase costs. So in Australia especially, we have very, very high upfront costs in order to get into the property market. So not only do you need to save your deposit, you need to potentially pay stamp duty, and then you need to pay the legal fees and everything else to get into the property. Now, that can all add up to be in the tens of thousands of dollars, especially when you think about deposit that's required for purchasing in a major capital city or a metropolitan area. So that can be a bit of the downside in terms of the upfront costs. Also, the ongoing cost and holding cost of having property can be quite expensive as well. So not only do you have the loan repayments you need to pay back to the bank, you also need to pay for property maintenance, you need to pay for rates, you need to pay for water. A lot of these other expenses that unfortunately a lot of people don't consider when they've gone from renting to buying, that maybe they didn't have to pay for when they were renting a property. So that then leads us to the thing of the pros and cons of renting. So the number one positive of renting is that it can potentially, but not always, cost less depending on where you live, because you're not paying for the property maintenance. You may or may not be paying for all of the utilities and services depending on which state you live in, but the property maintenance one is a big one, because unfortunately what renters don't see is exactly how much money can potentially go into maintaining a property. And especially if something goes wrong, you call your landlord, they come and fix it. So there's that side of it, which is a pro of renting a property. Another one there is the flexibility. Basically come and go when you want. You're not really responsible for that property to a point. If there's anything goes wrong, you call your landlord, they come fix it. So a lot more flexibility and I guess freedom when it comes to coming and going and not being tied down to one location. The downside of that is you don't get the capital appreciation of owning an asset. So a lot of times people talk about rent as dead money, and that is true to a point. However, there is a lot more that goes into that, so I won't bore you with that today. But the thing to think about there is that you don't own the asset, so therefore you're not getting that capital appreciation. So that is one of the downsides of renting a property, is that you are effectively just paying for a service. The service is to provide a roof over your head, and therefore you're not getting the capital appreciation, which can be a bit of a downside. So hopefully that's helpful. Next question came in from Alex. Alex asks, what are some ways of tracking my expenses and being better with budgeting? So Alex, thanks for the question. Obviously a topic I'm very, very passionate about. We've covered this in a lot of different episodes, so by all means, do a quick search and I'm sure you'll find some other ones that are helpful. But in short, it's really important to, one, understand exactly what you're earning, understand exactly what you're spending. So list out all your expenses. We've got a couple of free resources that we've listed in previous episodes, so you can have a search for those. But have a look and list out all your possible expenses. Make sure that you're not missing anything to understand exactly where are you right now. And similar answer that I gave in the previous question, understanding, do we have an income problem or do we have an expenses problem? Now, once we know what our income and expenses are, then it's a matter of how can we make changes to make sure that we have more income coming in than expenses going out, i.e. creating some savings. So understanding that, and then it's a matter of how do we actually track your expenses? So it's one thing to know right now what your expenses are, and the next thing is to track and create some accountability. Now, if you can't create that accountability yourself, then it's a matter of finding an accountability buddy. So this might be a partner, a friend, family member to say, hey, I want to be better with money. Can you make sure that I'm not spending ridiculous things? I'm not doing things that I shouldn't be doing. So there's a number of free different apps out there. We have one called My Prosperity that we use, which you can find on our website. Other ones like Pocketbook, I believe Money Smart have one as well. So there's a number of different apps that allow you to track your expenses. So that's one thing to make sure you stay on track with what you're aiming to do. The other one that is really important is having some clear goal in mind. So rather than just trying to say, I want to be better with my money, it's understanding why and what you're aiming for. So a lot of times people are like, oh, I can't save. I just can't do this. I can't do that. It's like, well, what are you aiming for? What are you trying to save for? And a lot of times they don't have that clear goal in mind. So getting that clear goal allows you to be saying, hey, I'm not just saving for saving's sake. I'm saving for something. So now that might be, I'm saving to build up 3 or 6 months worth of emergency savings. Maybe I'm saving up for a house deposit. Maybe I'm saving up for a holiday. Whatever that is, it gives you that clear goal in mind to allow you to propel forward and stay on track. So hopefully that's helpful. Next question came in from Rachel. Rachel asks, what are some ways that I can reduce my taxable income and legally pay less tax? Now, Rachel, a couple of things to think about here is understanding what industry or occupation you're in is going to be dependent on what you can and can't claim. So the ATO do a really good job of listing out all the, not all, but a majority of the possible deductions that people in certain industries can claim. So for instance, airline hostesses or hosts have different claimable work deductions they can claim compared to maybe an office worker. A nurse may be able to claim certain things that someone in advertising might not be able to. So it's understanding your occupation and industry and finding out all the possible work-related deductions that you can claim. Now, I'm making the assumption in this instance that you are an employee working for someone. So if you run your own business, that's a whole different kettle of fish that I won't get into today. But it's understanding, okay, what am I eligible to claim? Do I work in an office? Do I have to travel? So there's travel claims you can make. Do I work at home? So that opens up a few different avenues as well. So it's understanding all those and making sure that you either do it yourself or you work with a licensed accountant to get all the possible deductions that you can potentially claim. The second thing to think about is once you've exhausted that option is if you do have additional cash, you could potentially look at the option of making some tax deductible contributions into superannuation. Now it's a trade-off here of putting money into superannuation, you get a potentially get a tax deduction today, but the trade-off is that you can't touch that money until you're much older and retired from the workforce. So that's a bit of a tricky one, but it's just important to understand, okay, what are you actually trying to do? Do you have a tax problem? So have you sold a property and you've got capital gains tax you need to pay? Are we talking about just wanting to pay less tax just for the sake of it? So there's all these different things that you need to think about here, but those would be the main two, is maximizing any work-related deductions that you can legally claim. And then the other thing to think about is, okay, what could I potentially do to maybe salary sacrifice or add some additional money into superannuation? So there's some two options for you there. Next question came in from Lily. Lily asks, how can I save on everyday items such as groceries, utilities, and living expenses? So Lily, a couple of things to think about here. Groceries is what we call one of our high risk categories. So I'm very passionate and have lots of tips on how to save on groceries. I'll start on the other side with living expenses, utilities, those kind of what we call more fixed expenses. So when it comes to utilities, phone, internet providers, that type of thing, it's always a really good idea to not always just stay with one provider. So we usually find that most people, they sign up to one provider when they maybe first move out of house, move out of home, or they buy their own house, and they just stay with that one provider because it's just easier. And it's, they make it really, really hard for people to change for that reason. So that if you make it hard, people will just be reluctant to change. So there's that, what we call a loyalty tax. By staying with one provider, you being loyal to them, you may or may not pay more in the future. So it's always a really good idea to list out all your providers, do some research, and if you think you can get a better deal, contact your current provider, say, hey, look, I'm gonna move from Telstra to Optus or vice versa. They're offering me this, can you match it? So rather than having to go the whole headache of actually changing, maybe changing numbers and all that kind of thing, it's easier to stay with your provider. So if you can get them to give you a better deal without having to go through the nightmare of changing, because they don't want you to leave either. So it's just trying to find that compromise of like, hey, Telstra, Optus are offering me $20 less per month for my phone plan or my internet plan. Can you match it? If not, great, I'm moving. So don't be afraid to move, but you always just obviously negotiate a little bit at the start as well. Now, when it comes to groceries, that's a really big one. So it's looking at where do you shop. Now, if you're in a metropolitan or major capital city, that's going to be different if you're in a regional town. But it's understanding, okay, where do you shop? What are your options? So we've got Coles, Woolworths, and Aldi are the top three that most people know about, or most people have access to in Australia. Maybe there's farmers markets and things like that, which kind of come into it as well. But it's understanding what is a reasonable amount of money that you are willing to spend to feed you and your family. And then it's a matter of how can we potentially get a better deal. So if the goal is to save as much as possible on groceries, then I'd be thinking about, okay, how do we make a meal plan for the week? And so then when we go to the grocery store, we're not just buying unnecessary things. So the biggest challenge that we find people have when it comes to groceries is they go grocery shopping with no plan, so therefore they just buy whatever they think they need for the week, and they typically end up overspending. The other thing is they don't consider what they already have in their pantry or their fridge. It's easier just to go and buy new stuff. So I always suggest that before you go into a grocery shop, you make a list of all the items that you currently have in your pantry, in your fridge, and you make a clear list of what you actually need and what's reasonable for the week ahead. The other thing is thinking about meal planning. So meal planning is like looking at, say, well, what meals are we going to have throughout the week? Therefore, create your shopping list based on that. The other thing which can be really helpful is doing online shopping. So going on to Coles or Woolworths, and they have online shopping availability, which allows you to see how much you're going to spend and then click to purchase. Now, that's a big challenge because a lot of times people just fill up their trolley when they're walking in store. They get to the counter, they're like, oh shit, I'm $50 over what I thought. It's maybe embarrassing or not very comfortable to put things back or take things out of the trolley. So then we end up just paying extra. So that way, if we do online shopping, so click and collect or maybe delivery, then we can see exactly what we're spending and we can stick to the budget. So those would be a couple of tips for you there. All right, so the final question on today's episode comes from Cooper. Cooper asks, how can I save for a house deposit in Australia? So this kind of leads on to the similar answers that I'll give to some of those previous questions that we've had. Is it's all about understanding your income, understanding your expenses, and what can you be saving. Now, that sounds very simplistic. It's not easy, but it is simple. So do we have an income problem? Do we have an expenses problem? Do I have the option to earn more? Is it possible to spend less? Can we do a bit of both? Anything to increase the saving. Now, again, it's really important to understand what we're saving for. So house deposit, that's a really good goal. But what does that look like? Is it a $10,000 house deposit? Is it a $200,000 house deposit? So understanding and educating yourself of what that number is, then we can get really clear of, okay, well, what do I need to be putting away each week, each month, each fortnight to get me to my goal in whatever time frame that is. So talking to a mortgage broker, going, talking to a financial planner and say, hey, I want to buy a house that's $750,000 or $1 million. What do I need for a house deposit? So the two things when it comes to buying a house, there's the house deposit, and then assuming you're taking it a loan, there is the loan serviceability as well. So that's going to come down to your income. So house deposit is the money that you need before you can buy the house. The loan serviceability is always going to be determined on what income you have, what expenses do you have, do you have dependents, are you single, in a relationship, all those things that can kind of add to that complexity. So understanding what that goal is and then setting a really clear time frame of, okay, I want to have a house deposit in 6 months, 12 months, 24 months. How much do I need to be saving each week, each fortnight to achieve that goal? Once we know that, then it's a matter of figuring out, okay, where are we going to store that money in the interim?